This is an ABC podcast. This is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
G'day, Warwick Long filling in for Nicolai Bailhartz today. And today on the Country Hour, well, it's a hot one, isn't it? The temperature's up across Victoria, and I know there hasn't been much rain lately, particularly for those in the north, southwest. I know you're going all right for rain this year, but is the hot weather going to get you cutting your crop for hay? Or can you still carry through? There's a bit of wind out there as well. 1300 977 222 is the number you can call to talk to us on the Country Hour. You can text as well, 0467 842 722. Send us a photo if you're out cutting crops or silage or hay or any of that today, 0467 842 722. Also today, what did Barnaby Joyce actually achieve as the special drought envoy for the federal government? We're going to talk about that with Labor soon. And the effigy of Water Minister David Littleproud that we spoke so much about at the Tokenwall Basin Plan Rally is still floating down the Murray.
He's been quietly going down the river and he's had a few hiccups. He's been snagged a few times and he's been with fishermen and today he's actually with someone on a houseboat just up from the Chica Bridge.
An update on that and more today on the Country Hour.
On ABC Radio Victoria, you're with Warwick Long for the Victorian Country Hour.
Let's start with the news today out of Canberra that Barnaby Joyce hasn't prepared a single report on the drought, despite being appointed the nation's special drought envoy more than a year ago. Is that acceptable to you? 1300 977 222 is the number you can call or text 0467 842 722. The revelation was unearthed when Drought Minister David Littleproud wrote to Parliament to say the government would not be making any reports by the Special Drought Envoy public because no such report exists. Shadow Agriculture Minister Joel Fitzgibbon can join us now to talk about it. Welcome to the Country Hour.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
Why do you think it was important to find out if Barnaby Joyce had written a report whilst drought envoy?
Well, for a whole range of reasons. We understand that Joyce was allocated two additional staff, extra resources, and, of course, additional travel entitlements to undertake this task he's been given. But it appears he did no real work, and I think that's evidenced by the fact that he's delivered no report to the Prime Minister. The other second point is that since the government tore up COAG's drought reform program in 2013, at that stage, Tony Abbott and Barnaby Joyce were in charge, the government's been finding excuses to kick drought initiatives down the road. You know, we had the drought coordinator, the drought envoy, the drought task force, the drought summit, and of course, every time the government makes these appointments or holds these forums, it's an excuse to do nothing until after those reports are complete. And here we are 6 years on and well and truly into a very severe drought. And we've had plenty of talk but no real action.
You think they're using these roles and these reports as a way of kicking the issue down the road?
Of course they are. And it was worse than that in the case of envoys Abbott and Joyce, because it's well known in Parliament that those appointments were really made to keep Abbott and Joyce quiet. Morrison was, you know, heading into an election. Both Abbott and Joyce were agitating to come back to the front bench, so he gave them these fictitious roles to play. And, of course, that came at great expense to the taxpayer. But it's also an insult to rural communities suffering from drought, the fact that their problem was being used as a political pawn to silence Barnaby Joyce.
To be fair, though, he may not have written a report as drought envoy, but Barnaby Joyce was very visible in that role and travelled to a lot of communities or a lot of media events, forums, that kind of thing.
And that's the point, Warwick. He campaigned, really, around the country, expressing concern for farmers and rural communities so that the pressure would be taken off Scott Morrison on that same issue. So in other words, they looked to be caring and that was their response. But if nothing came of his visits, then really he's been no assistance to farmers or those communities.
Barnaby Joyce has said in a statement to the ABC he reported directly to the Prime Minister on numerous occasions, put forward particular concerns of farmers, then interacted with government departments and charities as well. Is that not good enough?
Well, we asked these questions in the Senate this week, Warwick, and the only formal response we've had is from Minister Littleproud, who clearly said that he can't deliver us a report from Barnaby Joyce because he never ever submitted one. Now, if taxpayers are paying potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars for additional staff and resources to Barnaby Joyce, I think they'd expect a bit more than him backgrounding the ABC trying to argue that, you know, he briefed Scott Morrison, I suspect, over a beer.
He started that role in August, finished after the last federal election. Why are we only finding out now if he did his job or not?
Well, we've been pursuing these reports for some time. The other report is that done by the drought coordinator, Major General Stephen Day. Now, we know that the Major General did a report. I've spoken with Major Day about his work. He's a fine Australian. I suspect that he might have talked about in his report some of the failings of the government on the drought front, and that's why the government is not prepared to make his report available to us.
David Littleproud, the Minister for Drought Response, said Major General Day's report is remaining confidential because it's subject to deliberations of Cabinet. Do you expect then that you will get to see it at some stage?
Well, I'm wondering what the Australian community expects. I know that they would think that's just an excuse not to release the report. If I'm correct and they're not releasing the report because it's an embarrassment to the government, then sadly I suspect we will never see it, although we might try going down the Freedom of Information path.
And this brings us to the issue of drought response in general, and you talked about that these federal government's numerous responses to drought, which you're calling ineffective. Labor government beforehand dismantled the exceptional circumstances scheme. There really hasn't been anything concrete in terms of drought policy in place since. What should be done about drought policy in Australia whilst people are going through what is now the worst drought experience they've been through in some parts of the country?
Well, you're right. A Labor government did dismantle the old architecture with the support of the Liberal and National parties, the support of all the states, and the support of the National Farmers Federation and all those who they represent. The problem is that what we also agreed at the time is that we'd start again and build a new drought architecture, and we charged the COAG committee with progressing and developing what that new drought policy looks like. The problem is, when Tony Abbott and Barnaby Joyce came to office, they abolished that COAG committee and therefore tore up that process. As a result, we've lost 6 years. Now, I can't get 6 years back, just like I can't make it rain.
But to be fair, you're just talking about setting up a committee to look at doing something down the road, and that's what you're accusing the government of, is setting up committees to kick issues down the road.
No, COAG set up the committee, led by a Labor government then, and there was no intention for that to be drawn out. The COAG committee was given about five key principles on which to build a new drought architecture, and that, you know, would have been done within a year or two. Here we are 6 years on, and we don't have even the development ongoing of a new national drought architecture. All we do have from time to time is announcements about concessional loans and the like, which are proving to be no assistance to farmers. And, you know, what we need to do, Warwick, is one, we need to get income support right so that farmers, through no fault of their own, struggling with the drought, can get that sort of income support. Now, the government has made a mess of farm household allowance, and as we speak, they're taking farmers off farm household allowance because they say they've been on it too long. Second, you've got to accept that there's a link between climate change and drought, so you've got to have a mitigation policy. We don't have one really under this government. You've got to have an adaptation plan, which means all of us changing our behaviour, but government giving guidance to farmers to change their farming practices, moisture in the soil, water efficiency, and that. And you've got to build water infrastructure. Now, the last government to build a dam in Australia was actually a Labor government. They said they were going to build dams here, there and everywhere, but in 6 years they've not even turned a sod, let alone build a dam.
The Victorian government, Labor government down here, just ruled out building any more new dams. Do you think that is a good choice of policy?
Well, the first thing I'd say about that is that Victoria is not southeast Queensland, central Queensland, north Queensland or northern New South Wales. We're we're in effect talking almost about two different countries here. But of course, dams do have a role to play. Water infrastructure more generally has a role to play. They've got to stack up economically. I mean, the farmers have to be able to afford the water. The urban communities need to be able to afford the water. And of course, they've got to be done in a way which demonstrates that they're not going to do damage to the environment. Now, we've shown in the past that can be done. In some cases, the Franklin Dam in Tasmania was a perfect example right back in the early 80s. Sometimes that can be done, sometimes it cannot. But we can't just build dams alone. We've got to be smarter than that, because if it doesn't rain, the dams don't fill.
Back to the issue of drought policy. Obviously, you've been in your portfolio for some time. You've talked to a lot of people. What do you think a drought policy should be in Australia?
Well, first of all, you have to have an overarching drought plan nationally. And we simply don't have that. And Scott Morrison surely would not even try to argue he has, because he does not. I get back to the four foundational points: mitigation, adaptation, income support where necessary, and infrastructure.
So what does that look like?
Well, income support is easy. I don't know how the government could have got that so wrong. It's New Start with a more generous assets test. You've got to design it so people can actually secure it without going through 15,000 pages of paperwork. So that should be easy. Water infrastructure is actually doing, not just talking about it. Adaptation is community awareness, strategies to have urban and rural communities use water more efficiently. Of course, helping farmers embrace the very best and latest and modern farming techniques, so we're getting maximum water efficiency, more carbon in our soils, therefore more moisture retention. There's a whole range of things you can talk about in terms of adaptation for farmers. And of course, where did I start? Did I go to infrastructure? Mitigation. You know, this government says it's doing something about climate. You know, while we don't need to have to do anything dramatic about climate, where our contribution is 1.3% of the global total, what we do need to do is enough to be able to bring the rest of the world with us. So we can't be preaching to China, for example, responsible for 30% of emissions or thereabout, about getting their emissions down, if we're not doing something serious about it ourselves here in Australia.
Something to keep an eye on. But Joel Fitzgibbon, thank you very much for joining us today on The Country Hour.
A great pleasure, Warwick.
That's Shadow Minister for Agriculture, Joel Fitzgibbon. You can send us a text with your thoughts on that, 0467 842 722, 0467 842 722, to get in contact with us on The Country Hour. Gary from Rochi has already done that, and he said, "G'day, Wazza. Barnaby Joyce is just another minister wasting money and doing bugger all," says Gary on the text line, 0467 842 722, if you'd like to send a text. I did read what Barnaby Joyce said to the ABC in a statement last night during that interview with Joel Fitzgibbon. But this has just come up on Twitter in the last few moments, and it's Barnaby Joyce talking about this exact story. And he simply says, "Wrong, full stop. I compiled multiple reports which were sent direct to the Prime Minister, as well as hundreds of representation on behalf of those affected by the drought." That from Barnaby Joyce on the story that he's yet to produce a single report from his time as drought envoy. It doesn't sort of address the fact that David Littleproud, the drought minister, wrote to Parliament to say the government wouldn't make any reports by the drought envoy public because no such report exists. I think there's more to come here, and we'll just keep an eye on it for you. You can read more about it online at abc.net.au/rural. It's 19 past 12 on The Country Hour. We'll stay with politics and David Littleproud specifically as we talk about the protesters, which are closely tracking an effigy of Federal Water Minister David Littleproud as it floats down the Murray River. The effigy was thrown off a bridge into the river at a protest against the Murray-Darling Basin plan at the beginning of September. And let's start by going back to that protest, because there's some shenanigans involved here.
What do we want?
Water!
Where do we want it?
Michael, I'm in a scrum of media and irrigators right now, watching an effigy of David Littleproud be pulled out of a toilet on the back of a truck, and they are going to throw it into the Murray River.
Five,
this frustration continues,
four,
and here goes the effigy. You can hear it, Michael.
It's going in the river.
It all started at a rowdy and angry Basin Plan protest on September the 5th, where an effigy of Federal Water Minister David Littleproud that was stuffed in a toilet was grabbed by protesters and hurled from high on a bridge spanning the Newell Highway between New South Wales and Victoria down into the Murray River.
It's going in the river. The effigy of the Minister for Water, David Littleproud, being thrown into the Murray River as we speak.
Since then, the effigy has been floating on down the Murray. Pictures have appeared online of the minister's mannequin lying on the side of the river, hanging with fishermen and sitting on a houseboat. Protest organisers now want the effigy to make it to South Australia. One of them is Lindsay Schultz from Benjaroop in northern Victoria.
Yes, well, it was a mate of mine's idea, actually, to put a tracker in him. And so we've put him in and he's been quietly going down the river. And he's had a few hiccups. He's been snagged a few times. And he's been with fishermen. And today he's actually with someone on a houseboat just up from the Chica Bridge.
So you've kept an eye on him and you're making sure he's shepherded down the river.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't even know how to use a mobile phone probably, but my mate, his name's Robbie, but everybody calls him Dorcas because he's such a Dorcas, but he's the one that's the electronic nerd, and he's the one that's got it all working, and I just keep an update from him. But, yes, it's amazing how many people are looking out for him, and he's on a houseboat as we speak, you know.
One small thing I need to pick up on here, and Lindsay, that I need this story on. I'm calling shenanigans on this mannequin because when you threw him in the river, he didn't have any legs. Now all of a sudden, your effigy has legs. What's going on there?
Well, the reason is because actually the one that went over the side, the real one was too good to be thrown over the side, and we thought it might break. And so the actual one that went over the side never had the tracker in him, but the tracker went in that same day and he's headed off from there. So, yes, you're right, he didn't have legs then. But, you know, these politicians, they can grow legs.
What's the message you're wanting to send by doing this? Because this has clearly become a thing. When you see it online, there's a lot of talk about it. There's constant text updates on where this effigy's at. What's the message here?
Well, the message is that we're trying to get through to people about how much water is actually going down this river and out into the lower lakes and then out into the sea that could be used for irrigation and growing food for our nation.
There are people that say, and we had these texts to the Country Hour when your protest was going on, that you're playing the man and not the issue here. What's your response to that?
He is the man. He is in charge, and a lot of people say that he's taken on things that somebody else has done, but he is the man right now. Now, do you know that David Littleproud will not talk to us? Full stop. But David Littleproud is the minister, water minister, federal water minister, so he is at the man to make the decisions.
ABC Rural contacted Minister David Littleproud, who has declined to comment. His National Party colleague, the member for Nicholls, Damien Drum, says the effigy is all part of being in political life and highlights problems with the Basin Plan.
Well, I think for myself it's part of it. It's just part of the rough and tumble. It's part of David. He would consider that part of the rough and tumble. Some people take offence. Ultimately, it is a sign of the pain. It's a sign of the damage. It's a sign of the suffering that these people are going through. So we get that.
So how far can the minister's effigy go? Lindsay Schultz.
There is a little sign on him, you know, that if you do find this, to ring me and let me know and put him back in the middle of the river and whatever. So, yes, so far so good. And the people that have got him on the houseboat at the moment, and I agreed with them, that if he's just ready to go down through the middle of Chica and Moama now, I know that someone might want to grab him and take him and sit him up on the town clock or something, but it's so important that we get him to the mouth of the Murray and just see how long it takes him to get there and how much water will go out the mouth of the Murray in the time it takes him to get there. That's what we're trying to... That's the message we're trying to get through to the politicians.
So in a couple of weeks, he's gone from Tokemall to Echuca. You could be in this for the long haul.
Well, it's a long way. He's at the 1,700 and... he's at the 1,714 marker, so he's still got 1,714 kilometres to go before he gets to the mouth of the Murray.
That is Basin Plan protest organiser Lindsay Schultz from Northern Victoria, ending that report there. We'll keep an eye on it. I don't know how watchful, but we'll see how far that effigy goes. It's 24 past 12.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
And as you've been hearing all of this week on the Country Hour, analysts believe one quarter of the world's pigs have been killed now by African swine fever, and that number is rising. So how are pig farmers in Australia feeling about this? How likely is it that they'll see the virus here? And what can be done to keep it out? Rural reporter Angus Verley spoke to VFF Pig Group President Tim Kingmar.
Oh, very concerned, mainly because there's no vaccine for it. So if it gets to Australia, it's an exotic disease that we can't control. We can only destroy herds to get on top of it.
We've seen in China, Simon Quilty, a livestock analyst, he believes could be close to 70% of Chinese pigs killed by the end of the year. Do you think we could possibly see those sorts of numbers here in Australia if it did make it here?
I suspect in Australia we have a higher chance of keeping it under control, mainly because my understanding of China is there's a lot of backyard producers. So they've all got a sow or two, they produce litters, they share boars, so therefore the chance of spread's a lot easier. Whereas in Australia, gone are those days where a lot of farmers have a little number of pigs. It's now become bigger family farms or corporate piggeries. So I think we've got better control of our herds. If I was to then think about, so therefore our biggest risk is potentially if it got into our wild pig population, because we can't control that.
And Tim, how likely do you think it is that eventually, ultimately, it could reach our shores?
Oh, it's always a possibility. I've been in contact with our state CVO. I know our national body's in consultation with government, and we just really, as producers, need to keep talking to the politicians and the people that govern, you know, our border controls. We're in a fortunate position. We're surrounded by ocean, and we've just got to really protect our borders.
So you don't think enough is being done at our borders at the moment to keep those diseases out?
I guess my fear... I've talked about if it got into a wild pig population. The other area of concern is cultures that bring meats back. So if you've gone overseas and in your culture you eat, you know, meat products and you bring them back to Australia, and then their scraps get fed to a pig in the backyard. So I think they're also risk factors. So it's not something, you know, I do if I go overseas, but I know lots of cultures do like to bring meats back. My ultimate wish would be that every person that comes into Australia is screened, whether it's a dog, whether it's some sort of x-ray machine that can look for meat products, because our agriculture in Australia is too important to risk.
You talked about biosecurity measures on your farm. Have you heightened those measures in light of ASF?
Yeah, we definitely have. I felt we've always, as a business, had fairly good measures. Like, we've always enforced our staff to shower in. We supply all the clothes and boots. Probably we've strengthened up our fencing, so that's to keep the wild pigs out, to make sure that no wild pigs can come in. The other thing we've done is now we don't allow staff to bring any pork products, into the smoko room for some small risk that there's a scrap that goes into the bin and somehow it finds its way into the piggery. And at every staff meeting we have monthly, we talk about ASF, we talk about what we're all doing, and it's front of mind.
There's a lot of talk at the moment about animal activists and the threat that they could pose to biosecurity. Do you think that if ASF did reach our shores and then we had activists trespassing onto farms, that they would actually heighten the spread?
Oh, there's no doubt. Anyone that came on your farm, animal activists, yes, because they definitely wouldn't shower in and put my clothes and boots on, but it also could be my local electrician.
On the other side of the coin, Tim, are there opportunities for Australian pork producers at the moment when there are other countries that have ASF and aren't producing the numbers of pork that they typically would? Can Australia capitalise on that?
Oh, for sure. And I guess we already have in some regards. Like 18 months ago, 2 years ago, we hit rock bottom in pricing. And for a rough example, you know, it got down to $2.50 a kilo, whereas now we're close to $4. Give or take 20 cents, depending on your market. So that's a massive increase. Partly some farmers got out of the industry because of the hard times and the drought, but there's also a world shortage of pork. So it's helped raising the price. So it's good for us farmers because all of a sudden, rather than the 12% that left the industry, those that are still in it, can now see a future in the pig industry, but it's also a chance for us to look at these markets. We don't need to get a big market to improve our stake in the world thing. We just got to find a little market. We have very good image on the world stage and supply a premium product. So there's great opportunity for us there.
Positive attitude there from the VFF Pig Group President, Tim Kingmar. He was speaking to Angus Verley. Should say, great stories online on the ABC Rural site about things like swine fever. If you want to hear more about what analysts are saying, you can look at some photos and read a lot more about the effigy going down the river. And you can read that article on Barnaby Joyce's role in as a drought envoy if you head online to our website, abc.net.au/rural, if you want to read more. abc.net.au/rural. It's 12:30 here on the Country Hour. Let's find out what's making news around regional Victoria. Christopher Tester can do that for us today. Good afternoon, Christopher.
Good afternoon, Warwick. Homicide Squad detectives are expected to question a woman after the death of a man in Port Fairy in Victoria's southwest this morning. Paramedics attempted to revive the man after he was found injured at a caravan park on the Princes Highway about 2:30, but he died at the scene. A woman, who police believe was known to the victim, has been arrested. Four people have escaped unharmed from a house fire at Fulham near Sale this morning. A man woke to a crackling noise about 4:30 and alerted the other residents to the fire. The single-storey brick home on the Sale Hayfield Road was fully alight when crews arrived. The CFA duty officer, Peter Barr, says it's believed the fire started in the laundry. Emergency crews are trying to repair a gas leak in Castlemaine. The CFA is advising residents around Kennedy and Forest Streets to remain indoors and avoid the area. The gas leak affected V-Line services. V-Line says rail services have now resumed from the number 2 platform at Castlemaine. Water carting to the remote Darling River town of Pooncarie starts today, as the raw water supply is about to run dry. Pooncarie's potable water comes from an emergency bore, but raw water used for gardens and toilets comes from an increasingly saline weir pool in the Darling River. New South Wales Environment Department Director of Inland Water Planning, Peter Hyde, says the town's raw water supply is likely to run out within a week. A Victorian schoolteacher has been sentenced to 4.5 years jail for what a county court judge described as a terrifying attack on a defenceless woman. Daniel Mongan bound the woman's hands and legs with cable ties and tried to gag her with duct tape after ambushing and threatening to kill her at her home in July last year. She managed to escape. The 40-year-old was given a 3.5-year non-parole period and, with time served, could be released in August 2021. And that's all the news for now. For more, visit abc.net.au/news.
Thanks, Christopher.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Just going to go to the Weather Bureau in a few moments' time. Before that, a few of your texts to 0467 842 722 on a number of issues. We've been speaking to the Shadow Agriculture Minister, Joel Fitzgibbon, about the reports, well, the lack of reports made by Drought Envoy Barnaby Joyce when he was in that role, with government saying they can't supply a report because there aren't any. They're also been talking about the effigy floating down the river and also swine fever as well. Some of your text, Bill in Redcliffs on 0467 842 722 says the ABC is giving the ridiculous Little Proud effigy too much air. The water being complained about is not these people's to take. ABC should look at the facts and educate these suffering people. That's from Bill at Redcliffs. Grumpy Granny says, I don't think I'm getting my 8 cents worth with the rubbish Joel Fitzgibbon is sprouting. Well, Grumpy Granny, if you don't want to hear from someone on the Labor side of Parliament, I can tell you almost nnearly to the day, on the 21st of August, we had the Nationals Federal Agriculture Minister Bridget McKenzie answering questions for a full hour on the show. That podcast is available online if you want to go find it. Search Victorian Country. I think 21st of August is the date you're looking for there. What are these water whingers doing to help themselves apart from polluting the river? Says a texter who describes themselves as me in brackets. So thank you very much for that text. At Corowa, Bluey says the Murray River is running full ball at summer irrigation level, same last year for 3 months with zero water allocations. Where could it be going? Could some expert please explain without telling a heap of lies, says one person on the text line. And another one says, Warwick Joel Fitzgibbon says he suspected that Barnaby reported to the PM over a beer. There's no way he could know that unless he was there. Why didn't you challenge him, Ian? Ian, is that the one thing you really wanted me to challenge him on out of all of that interview? Anyway, thank you very much for your commentary. 0467 842 722 is the text. Yeah, let's build some more dams, says this one, so we can increase the water allocation, sort of like painting the Sydney Harbour Bridge, says another texter as well. Keep them coming. 0467 842 722. Let's check in on the weather now. I did mention earlier that it's hot. It's windy today. Just wondering if anyone's out there cutting crops. Jim Keogh, north of Yarrawonga, sent a... Well, it's a beautiful photo, Jim, but I'd imagine it doesn't look beautiful for you outside of the tractor cab. He says, hey, mate, we're cutting canola for hay north of Yarrawonga, and you can certainly see all of that canola on the ground there. Keep those texts coming as well. I'd love to see what you're up to if you could keep telling us what's happening around Victoria on today, especially with the warm weather. Kiris Arndt can tell us much more about the warm weather that's around Victoria today. So the senior forecaster at the Weather Bureau. G'day, Kiris.
Hey, Warwick.
Hot day, windy day. That's pretty much the description in northern Victoria. Is it the same for everyone else in the state?
Pretty much, yeah. It's been very hot and windy. There's some dust up in the northwest, which we're getting a lot of recently. It's likely to hang around for most of the day. We've got the severe weather warning out for elevated areas, but even away from that's for wind gusts up to 100 kilometres an hour or so about the eastern ranges. But even away from there, it's been pretty windy everywhere. It's a lot warmer than we have seen recently as well. We've already reached 30 up in Mildura this afternoon, 29 at Swan Hill. And then even down towards Orbost, it's 27 degrees as well. So across the state, yeah, 28 at Bairnsdale. So all through the state, it is warm. So, yeah, definitely heading that way, away from winter. It's a fair bit of cloud still across most of the state, however, although we're not going to see any rainfall until very late at night, if ever, more likely tomorrow at this stage. So, yeah, the story for today is warm and windy, so I think you nailed that one.
What happens then from here? Is this as warm as it gets for a little while?
Yes, it is at this stage. So there's a change coming through tomorrow, so things are going to be shaken up a little bit. Some cooler air moving across the state during the day. It's a bit of a complicated wind change. So the winds drop out through the west and central parts during the morning, and then eventually they will get a southwesterly push through, but there'll be a period where it's just kind of jumping all over the place a bit wind-wise. Hangs around a little bit longer, the stronger northerlies in the east of the state, and that's what that severe weather warning is for damaging wind gusts overnight tonight and into tomorrow morning. So it still stays windy through that area and through the central ranges as well in the early morning. But as that southwesterly pushes through, the cooler air will move across, so that's the end of those warmer conditions. And we're going to see showers through most of the state tomorrow. As I said, we could see some sneak into the southwest very late tonight, and potentially even a thunderstorm as well. But the real event as far as rainfall goes is through tomorrow. So that'll extend across in the morning from the southwest and head everywhere else during the day. Most rainfall probably about the southwest, where we could see around 10 to 20 millimetres, and then up about the northeast ranges in the afternoon, could see anywhere up to 25 millimetres or so. Elsewhere, though, we're not looking at too much, generally kind of less than 5, and up in the far northwest, probably just a couple of millimetres at the most. Thunderstorm activity could also could add to those totals locally. So there'd be pretty isolated thunderstorm activity, I think. And it could be pretty gusty with thunderstorm as well as it comes through. Thunderstorms are most likely in the south of the state, and then up in the northeast ranges is where we're going to see most of the activity tomorrow, I think. And again, very gusty near thunderstorms. Could also see a bit of small hail come through in the colder air in the south later in the day. And that's likely to continue into Sunday as well, with the cool air really sticking with us. So we've lost our warm nights, and we've lost our warm days as well, actually. We're likely to see some showers persist about the south of the state, and potentially some more thunderstorms about the coast on Sunday as well, with some small hail. But as far as big rainfall totals go, there's not much in there. It's more stream showery kind of stuff. it's a chance of maybe up to 10 millimetres or so about the far southwest on Sunday. But apart from that, there's not much reaching anywhere else, just a couple of millimetres here or there. And that's really the story through most of the week. We don't see much change after that. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then things fine up a little bit more as the high really moves over us and we get some warmer days again. So
that'll be cool. Back to warm by the end of next week, is it?
By the end of the week, yeah. It stays pretty cool until then, which I'm sure is good for some people. I know some people are enjoying the spring, so, can't please everyone, I guess.
Oh, it's a hard thing about your job, isn't it? As soon as you say something's good in a weather report, there are a lot of people to tell you it's actually bad for them.
That's right. Avoid the good weather, avoid the nice weather words, and some people will enjoy this,
I would love to see the media training for some bureau staff at some stage. Before we let you go, though, we are going into the weekend, Keris. Anything in the way of warnings or anything that we should be aware of?
Just the severe weather warning at this stage. So that's for damaging wind gusts through central ranges, so central highlands, kind of east of Ballarat. And that's likely from very late tonight, so 10 or 11 o'clock, sea winds pick up that way. And then extend eastwards into the eastern ranges, and winds will be a little bit stronger up there as well before it all contracts away to the east, clearing the east of the state by, say, 3 or 4 tomorrow afternoon.
I was going to say nice. I was going to say good. I'll just say thank you. Thank you, Keris.
Excellent.
Keris Arndt at the Weather Bureau taking us through the forecast for the next week or so. There's a bit of everything, as you heard. The warmest day being today, but then warming up again by the end of next week. A little bit of rain and so forth through the place between now and then. This text from Stephen at Kirwa. I suppose what you'd say it's just near Wentworth, isn't it, in southern New South Wales, very much northwest part of Victoria. It says, hi, Warwick. Yep, hot and windy. And this bloody dust, says Stephen at Kirwa. A few more of your texts at 20 to 1 all sorts of issues. Header Monkey says, how ironic, Warwick, that the government makes it so complicated to access drought funding, arguing they don't want the wrong people accessing the money, and then they give it to Barnaby's department to do something that it never does. Has anyone considered that a money drop over a drought-affected area might be more effective? Says Header Monkey with a smile, I'm sure. Another one says, Tony from Avenel on the effigy floating down the Murray. He said, the so-called effigy is just plastic and e-waste rubbish, and the people who threw it into the Murray should be punished for littering and or vandalism. Their anti-social act reflects a lack of civility, poor attitudes, and suggests they have no real concern or respect for the health of our river. No sympathy, says Tony at Avenel. You can keep the texts coming. 0467 842 722.
On ABC Radio Victoria, you're with Warwick Long for the Victorian Country Hour.
And we'll move away from politics and the river, and we'll talk about your health now on the Country Hour, with farmers being warned about silicosis, the deadly lung disease that's being found in Victoria. There are 61 confirmed cases in the state, a number that's expected to rise. And silicosis is typically seen as a tradies disease, but farmers have been added to the list of those affected alongside miners and engineers. Dr. Jane Burke is a senior lecturer with Monash University's Biomedicine Discovery Institute, and she's speaking here with Jane McNaughton.
Silicosis is an occupational lung disease. It's been appearing in increasing numbers in Australia recently, and it's caused by inhaling really small particles of dust called silica, and these can get into the lung and the lung's not able to clear them. And as a consequence, over time, as that dust builds up, it causes scarring in the lung, and that's what's making it difficult to breathe. The body can normally clear things that we breathe in that don't belong there. The problem is that silica dust can't be broken down by these cells, so instead of clearing it from the lungs, the silica actually makes these cells start producing toxic chemicals in the body, and that's what eventually leads to the scarring.
What kind of materials can cause the silicosis reaction?
So commonly it occurs as a consequence of grinding or mashing up stone. The amount of silica in different types of stones varies. It's also present in concrete dust. And it can also even be present in soil, because silica really the same as sand, but it's just very tiny respirable, as in that ones that can get breathed in that go down into the lungs. So it's the same substance as sand,
but it's a crystalline form of that that ends up causing the damage and the very small particles getting in the lung.
Are people aware that silicosis can be caused by things like concrete and soil?
Much less so, because of course all the recent publicity has been around the engineered stone that's been used to make kitchen benchtops. But it's really important that people who are handling other sorts of material that can generate this dust are also protecting their lungs from inhaling it.
How often are farmers affected by silicosis?
I did look into whether this was something that affected farmers as well. So, of course, farmers have a lot of environmental exposures to things that they breathe in, whether that be chemicals they're spraying their crops or, you know, dust and things that are generated from hay, for example, inhaled substances that can damage the lung. It is definitely much less common in terms of a lung disease that's associated with silica, but they can cause other diseases that may be just as serious as silicosis.
Do you think that the fact this is in the media being played out as a tradies disease is doing a disservice to people in other industries who may be affected?
Yeah, I agree with that completely. So we know even historically from asbestos, it wasn't necessarily just people who worked in asbestos mines that were ending up with that disease. It was people who were exposed to it in other, you know, even quite small amounts. So it's really, really important that people are wearing masks, they're working in ventilated areas. And obviously, if they're doing the cutting of stone or anything that involves generating dust, whether it be from concrete or from stone or even raising dust from dirt and things like that, that they're really doing it in a way that they're stopping these things from getting into their lungs in the first place. A short burst of a high dose of silica is actually more damaging than longer-term exposure to low doses. If the dose is very high, there's an acute form of silicosis that causes really severe symptoms. It may not necessarily lead to long-term disease, but it's more like an acute attack, essentially, of silicosis.
So by the sound of that, someone who decides to fix the shed or the dairy on the weekend, for example, could be exposed from just one occasion. What are the symptoms that they should be looking out for?
Short-term symptoms can be cough and breathlessness, which is almost like asthma symptoms. As this dust accumulates in the lung, people get fatigued as well because they're not getting enough oxygen into their blood.
Some of those symptoms you describe sound like the effects of something like smoking.
The smoking comment you mentioned is interesting because a lot of people in regional areas do smoke, and smoking does increase the risk of lung damage by itself and can also make you more susceptible to the effects of dust. Anybody who's concerned about their symptoms should really be going to their doctor and at least making their doctor aware of their exposure so that they can be monitored.
Obviously, silicosis has really only been in the spotlight for the last 12 months. A lot of people have been critical that the government hasn't done enough. What's your message to the government?
Well, they are starting to take heed of the potential risk for so many workers and doing a lot in terms of screening and trying to support clinicians to be able to help with diagnosis. But in the long term, we're going to end up with a lot of people with this disease who are going to need to be treated. Not only it's important to identify people who potentially have this disease, but help support research in terms of treating patients and finding new treatments, because really there's not very much there that's going to stop disease progression.
That's Dr. Jane Burke, Senior Lecturer with Monash University's Biomedicine Discovery Institute, speaking there with Jane McNaughton. It's 12 to 1 here on the Country Hour. And the Victorian Farmers Federation wants on-the-spot fines of $1,000 for anyone who trespasses onto farms, and the extension of the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act to apply to activists. That's what the inquiry into the impacts of animal activism on Victorian agriculture was told when it held a public meeting in Horsham. VFF Livestock Group President Leonard Valance says activists are taking their views too far.
Well, we live in a society which is very free, where everyone's entitled to their opinions and able to express them, but that doesn't allow them to enter businesses and disrupt the business, and that's what activists are doing on farms.
Now, you talked about biosecurity risks. You used the example of African swine fever and how it's decimating the pork industry. Is that a real concern when trespassers are coming onto farms?
Any disease which comes onto a farm is a concern to a livestock farmer and a cropping farmer, for that matter. So, yes, African swine flu is rampaging through the world's piggeries at this point in time, and it's going to cause a serious protein shortage around the world. So foot and mouth disease is almost as prevalent around the world at this point in time, and it's a real threat to Australian agriculture.
Biosecurity aside, how about animal welfare? That's something you talked about quite a bit this morning.
This inquiry is not actually about animal welfare. It's about some people's views on animal welfare, which are not compliant with the industry standards. The Australian agricultural industry has developed codes of practice for handling animals and treatment of animals in collaboration with the RSPCA and government and other industry bodies around the country. And so these activists are using animal activism and animal welfare as a point, but in fact they're actually ignorant of what the reality on the Australian farm is.
So the activists have said that they've got animal welfare at the forefront of their minds. Is that something you refute?
I do refute that because you've only got to look at the way they handled the goats from the Gibby Goat Farm. They put them into a vehicle unrestrained, then they kept them in a house and put nappies on them. The mother goat became quite ill with mastitis and was consequently not able to do a job as a mother goat into the future. Now, if that's a good animal welfare outcome for anybody, I don't understand that.
Another point you made in your written submission was about the impact of activists on farmers' personal safety and their mental health, and you used a couple of examples this morning of people you know that have had run-ins with activists and it has really perturbed them.
The impact on the farmer himself, his wife and family, and extended family and their employees is considerable. Rural health in Australia is in an appalling state of affairs, and doctors are not available to farmers for treatment. And so this added stress just compounds an existing problem which rural people are really struggling to deal with.
Now, what does the VFF Livestock Group want the state government to do in response to this wave of activism?
Well, the base level is an understanding from the judiciary of the seriousness of the crimes being carried out, but also the minimum level of fines for invasion there and interference in commercial businesses, and that we also support on-the-spot fines and that they be imposed on people breaking the law.
So you think penalties do need to be lifted and also existing legislation needs to be enforced more stringently?
Definitely. And also that part of that is the judiciary has very little understanding of food production and the impacts it has on the people these people are targeting.
Do you think there's more of a broader issue at play here about a disconnect between urban communities and farming communities?
Oh, there's definitely a disconnect between the urban community population and their knowledge of where their food comes from, who grows it and where it's grown. The level of ignorance in today's society is appalling.
Do you think you were given a good hearing today by the committee?
I think the committee went very well, actually. I was quite pleased with the standard of questions and the hearing, diverse range of questions, but it all comes down to the end product that comes out of this committee. We want to see change, and if they don't bring about change, then why did we do it?
And how likely do you think it is that they will come up with recommendations that align with what you're asking for?
I think in our city areas, there's now a greater understanding of from people as to what these activists are doing, and we've got a long way to go yet, but we will get there. We will change the laws.
That's Leonard Valance, President of the VFF's Livestock Group, speaking there with Angus Verley. You're listening to the Country Hour, and Barry from Warrigal's called 1300 977 222, wanting to talk about the effigy, Barry.
Yeah, g'day, Warwick. Hey, I'm pretty crooked on all of these people who think the Country Hour is wasting time talking about the effigy. Do they understand how important the issue is that they are highlighting? I would like the organisers of the effigy to consider asking David Littleproud and Barnaby perhaps to meet them on the Pooncarie Bridge, where they can chuck a couple more effigies, one of Littleproud and one of Barnaby, and let's see how far that one goes down. And then maybe come out in the open and talk to the rest of us about what they can do about the Murray-Darling.
So use it as an excuse for more conversations. Barry, thanks for the call.
Thanks, Waz.
That's Barry at Warrigal on 1300 977 222. The text line's getting a bit willing as well, but we'll see if we've got time to update you on that. Let's go to the wine industry now on the Country Hour, and the Australian wine industry could be in for a shake-up in the years ahead due to what's being described as an overcrowded market. Winemakers and industry representatives from around the world met in the New South Wales cool climate region of Orange this week, looking at the state of the wine market. Tim Fuchs reports.
Is running a winery a wise business opportunity or more of a lifestyle choice? That's been one of the topics raised at a conference in Orange this week, which attracted around 150 people from around New South Wales and further afield. Among those there, Andrew Campus, who's a Canadian wine marketer based in the Napa Valley in California. He says while wineries in Australia have their own charm, they could learn from what is happening in the United States to increase their customer base.
The wineries are smaller, but very personable people. You don't have to have a reservation. They're not pompous. But I do think, it's very much, it's a lot like Canada. It's a lot like South Africa, the market. So it's very relaxed sitting in the tasting room and stuff. I do think that there are things that they could take away from like an American winery, though. For instance, grabbing that customer's email address or learning who that customer is, feeding, being able to take that experience and extend it to online after the person leaves. So say I'm from Sydney, I come up to the Hunter Valley or I come to Orange, I have a great time, they could email me a receipt and then later on they could be emailing me to tell me about events that they're doing, or they could get me to, continue my experience back when I'm at the office.
Okay, so is it a bit old-fashioned here?
I wouldn't call it old-fashioned, I call it more relaxed.
Wine Australia estimates there are nearly 2,500 wineries in this country. Felicity Carter is the editor of a wine magazine based in Germany, and she says the issue of a market inundated with wineries is a worldwide problem.
A huge proportion of the wine industry internationally is not profitable. There's too many people who get into it for the lifestyle and so don't really understand the economics of it very well. It would be very nice if it could make money. And actually, it's not that hard to make money. It's a matter of spreadsheets and planning just like in any other business. But there's a romance about wine and people kind of resist the idea that that they should sit down with an Excel spreadsheet and work it out. If you look at a country like France, the area under vine is shrinking because children don't want to take over their parents' farms because they can see how unprofitable it is and how hard their parents worked. So what's happening there is beginning to spread internationally. Yeah, so we're going to see a contraction in the next 10 years.
So what does it take for a winery to stand out from the rest? Matthew Moat is the CEO of Wine Industry Suppliers Australia and was involved in organising the conference. He's aware of the need for wineries here to get advice from overseas on how to try and get that competitive edge.
Wine industry, you don't do it because you want to make a lot of money. You do it because you love it. You like the lifestyle, etc. And it is, at the end of the day, it is an agricultural business. So it's just, it is a need to make sure that you can take every competitive advantage possible to be as competitive, to be as capable as possible, so that you can be above the pack. And yes, there is a very small number of what I'd call large wineries, and then it tails off with a very long tail of small to medium producers. And that's pretty much a common theme globally.
For local winemakers in a cool climate wine region like Orange, the need to keep up with the times and using technology to get people drinking wine is always up for discussion. Nicole Samadol is president of the Orange Region Vignerons Association and owner of Rowley Wines.
It is a crowded market. Australia, New South Wales and Orange are very fortunate, and we have very high quality wines, cool climate wines that people are seeking out more and more. And we've got a very engaged and enthusiastic local customer base, and they often bring their friends and relatives to the region. So it's really about how to share our love of cool climate wine with them and encourage them to become repeat customers.
That's Nicole Simmondale speaking there to Tim Folks. Let's go to markets now.
Agent's Pick.
She nearly rushed in there, but we'll go there now. Here's Caroline Ronald at Swan Hill Sheep.
Agents penned a reduced yarding of 7,625 sheep and lambs. The quality was mixed with a good selection of both old and new export type lambs available. All the regular field of processors were present, operating in a firm to dearer market. New season light and medium trade 158 to 184, heavy trade 205 to 215 to average 805 cents per kilo carcass weight. Heavy export lambs 220 to 236, the over 30 kilo lambs making between 243 and 253 to average 775 cents per kilo carcass weight. Old season lambs weighing over 30 kilos reach $235. Heavy crossbred ewes 138 to 152 to average 498 cents per kilo carcass weight. And the heavy four-score merino ewes 143 to 158. I'm Caroline Ronald for MLA at Swan Hill.
Thanks very much for that, Caroline. That's about all the time we have for you today on The Country Hour. Thanks very much for being involved in the show like you have today. A few great texts, actually, just before I go. There's one that's just come in of mowing canola at Cobram and Baruga, and it looks like it was such a good-looking canola crop too. And Bud says, "Hi, Woz. It's been so warm that I've put the shorts on. My legs are so white that my neighbour thought I'd started painting my fence posts." Bud, it's great to end the week with a little bit of humour. Thank you very much for getting involved in The Country Hour. Remember, you can find our stories online. If not, we'll be back at the same bat time on Monday. It's 1 o'clock.
This is an ABC podcast.